Chapter 24. The robots came to see me in the early afternoon. I had left Campion watching Mazerian's continued interrogation of Grilsa, and had returned to the private room where we had left Hesperus, exactly where he had been before we had taken him to the spirit. There had been no change in his condition since morning, but I felt obliged to keep vigil in case there was a flicker of life, a momentary attempt at communication that would otherwise be missed. "It was a very good effort," Cadence said, making me start by appearing at the door without warning. "You should not blame yourself for the lack of success." "It isn't a total failure," I said, noticing Cascade lurking just behind the female robot. "He's not attached to that mass anymore. He's been put back the way he used to be. Even his arm." "His arm?" the male robot quizzed. "There was human flesh beneath the metal skin of his left arm. He was trying to disguise himself as one of us, so that he could enter the vigilance." "We had no idea," Cadence said. "It doesn't matter now. But the point is, the spirit did something. It didn't just put him back on the platform exactly as he arrived. It saw what was wrong with him, what was damaged, or not to be expected." "Superficial matters," Cascade said. "Maybe. But what's to say it didn't look deep into him and fix what was wrong with him there as well? His broken memory, the damage he sustained in the attack by the H-gun." "The evidence would suggest otherwise," said Cadence, "although it pains us to admit it. He does not appear any more cognitively functional than when we last observed him."
"There are still lights in his head."
"But faint and hardly moving. You would be unwise to put too much stock in them."
"Do you think he's dead?"
I had the impression that the robots were exchanging thoughts. The air grew momentarily tense, as if accumulating charge before an electrical storm. "He's not beyond hope," Cadence said, sounding more doubtful than certain. "But with every day that passes, patterns may be lost. The sooner he is on his way to machine space, the better."
"We did not want to press you after the death of Cyphel," Cascade said, managing to sound kind and firm at the same time. "But if it is not too painful, perhaps we might discuss the matter of transportation again."
"I think we agreed everything that needed to be agreed," I said. "We've said goodbye to Cyphel, and I've got Hesperus back. If you want my ship, you can have her today."
"Are you certain?" Cadence asked.
"Totally. Take her. Get her out of my sight."
"That would be most satisfactory from our standpoint," Cascade said.
"If it helps Hesperus, if it helps the line, if it helps the machine people, I'm happy with it." Which was halfway to the truth. Before Cyphel's death, before the return of Hesperus, I had been indignant about losing Silver Wings. Now all I felt was emptiness, a sense that I had been betrayed and let down not just by elements of my line, but by the universe itself. Getting my ship back would make no difference to that. It would be like throwing a single stone into a canyon and hoping to fill it to the brim.
"There were things you wished to retrieve from the ship," Cadence said.
I nodded, although the task filled me with nothing resembling enthusiasm. "It won't take long. Most of those old ships should still be able to fly out by themselves."
"As we discussed, we will begin the process of familiarization with your vehicle systems while you evacuate the hold."
Cascade nodded his white mask at the golden form before us. "We may as well convey Hesperus into orbit now. That way we can also begin preparing him for the journey, as best as we are able." "I won't see him again, will I?"
"If he can be healed, and if you live long enough, anything is possible," Cadence answered.
"Maybe he won't even remember us. You can't be sure of that, can you?"
Cascade said, "We will ensure that his debt to you is made clear."
"It isn't about a debt. It's about friendship. We liked him. I think he liked us back."
"He is in safe hands now," Cadence said. "You need have no fear about that."
"Will you take care of moving him?" I asked. "I can have my shuttle ready at the main landing stage within the hour. Bettany will need to authorize a visit to orbit, but there shouldn't be any objection. This was his idea to begin with."
"This does not inconvenience you?" Cascade asked.
"It's not as if I had anything else planned today."
"Then your offer is most acceptable to us. We shall make the necessary arrangements for Hesperus." Take good care of him, I said. I left the robots with him and went back to the open auditorium, where I had last seen Campion. He was still sitting with Bettany and the others, keeping a careful eye on Mazarian. As I approached, he stood from his seat and moved to an empty position, out of earshot of the others. I went up to him and said, I'm going up to Silverwings, so that I can assign control to Cadence and Cascade. They're going to take Hesperus with them. Will you be long? I only need to empty the hold and authorize the change of ownership. I should be back on Naomi by midnight. At worst, breakfast. He made to move from his seat. I'll come with you. You don't have to. In all honesty, I'd rather you didn't come. It's going to be difficult enough handing that ship over, but having you up there as a witness will make it even worse. You know what she means to me. I understand, Campion said. This is something you'd rather do on your own. I'll be all right once I'm back down. I just wanted you to know where I was going. I promise I'll be fine. Don't let those machines take anything that isn't part of the deal. I won't. Trust me. He got up and kissed me, holding me tight until I forced myself free. They'll regret this one day, he said. They'll see that they did the wrong thing. Bettany probably knows it already. Seifel's death has put everything else into perspective, but he can't back down. Not now the offer's already been made to the robots. If they bring her back with a scratch on her, there'll be hell to pay. He smiled. That's the spirit. Now go up there and get it over and done with. I kissed him again. Our hands linked and then parted. I turned to Bettany, whom I sensed had been watching us. I'm going to my ship, to sign her over to the robots. I presume you have no objections? Of course not, he said, then looked back at Mazarian, as if he could not quite meet my eyes. Feeling a flicker of triumph, I walked away from the auditorium, my back straight, my head held high, to the landing stage. My shuttle was there by the time I arrived, and I did not have long to wait for the robots or their golden cargo. We lifted from Ymir without incident. I watched the spires fall away, curving the shuttle around so that I caught a fleeting view of the auditorium. Mazarian's array of panes glittered in the sun, spangles of light flashing from the 256 facets that had once been a single human being. I caught a glimpse of a tiny black-clad figure stalking between the panes, and then the ruby discharge of an energy pistol, and then another tower swung into place to block my line of sight. I pushed the shuttle higher, and was soon knifing into the high thin layers of atmosphere where we had played out Seifel's life. Behind me, the robot stood on either side of their fallen kinsman, who was resting horizontally between them. Their hands were pressing into him, one on each shoulder. As I had noticed when they had attempted to commune with him previously on Silver Wings of Morning, it was as if the gold armor of his skin had become as malleable as clay. I instructed the shuttle to match position and speed with my ship's polar orbit. Silver came quickly into view, enlarging with frightening rapidity until the shuttle braked viciously to avoid the collision that, until the absolute last moment, had appeared inevitable. Inside, we felt nothing of that brutal slowdown. The shuttle sent a command for the cargo bay to open, and we slipped inside the lovely chrome swan that had been my ship for so long. Selecting manual controls, I guided the shuttle through the maze of parked vehicles until I found the vacant docking berth I had used on my last visit. Field clamps locked it home. I set the drive to idle and we disembarked. Cadence and Cascade carried Hesperus. I strode ahead of them, walking through a good half-kilometer of bay until we reached the nearest whisking chamber. "Welcome, Purslane," said Silverwings, speaking directly into my head. "I see you are accompanied. Are they guests, or are you being coerced?" "I am being coerced," I thought sourly, "but by the line, not these innocent machines. They're friends of mine," I said aloud. "Please make them welcome. Cadence is the silver one, Cascade the white one." "Welcome, Cadence and Cascade." "Hesperus, you know," I said. "He's still unwell, but the robots are going to take him somewhere where he can be healed. In a little while I'll be assigning command authority to the robots, so you'll have a good chance to get to know them better." "Are you disposing of me, Purslane?" Silverwings asked, still in my head. "Not by choice. We'll talk about it on the bridge. If all goes well, we'll see each other again in 500,000 years or so." The whisking chamber was large enough to receive cargo, and therefore easily spacious enough for me and the three robots. I began to tap our destination into the hovering go-board, then looked back at my guests and hesitated. Hesperus whisked, so I'm assuming you can do it as well. That was before he was injured, though. Will he be all right? We can walk if you like, but the bridge is a good 15 kilometers away.
We can whisk, Cadence said. Hesperus will come to no harm.
If you're sure. A grid of lights in the chamber's walls flashed red to signify that the whisking field was about to activate, and that we should confine ourselves to the area indicated on the floor. There was a moment's bright rush, a subliminal sense of being syringed down swerving, chicaning tubes, and then, less than an eye blink later, we were standing in the counterpart to the first chamber, 15 kilometers up ship.
Has there been a mistake? Cascade asked, looking into the echoing, gloomy concourse onto which the whisking chamber had opened. This does not resemble the bridge I had imagined.
The bridge is still a little way from here, I said. There used to be a direct link between the cargo bay and the bridge, but that wasn't a very good idea. It made the ship too vulnerable to attack by infiltrating parties. It was like putting an express elevator between the city gates and the mayor's office, asking for trouble.
Do we have far to go now?
Just a stroll. The concourse was ringed by whisking chambers. I pointed to the one opposite us and set off at a brisk pace, leading the robots across a bridge. Above and below, rising and plunging to similarly dizzying vanishing points, stretched a shaft filled with slowly moving anvil-shaped mechanisms. Local gravity here was aligned with Silver Wing's long axis, so the shaft ran most of her length, until it butted against the mountainous bulkhead of the cargo bay. The machines were engaged in a never-ending process of repair and overhaul. Every sixth whisking chamber was designed for cargo as well as people. The rest were only large enough to take one or two people at once, but there were enough of those to accommodate hundreds of simultaneous journeys. Although her origins were buried almost beyond recall, it was evident from the capacity of her whisking system, which predated the redesign to prevent borders, that she had once been intended to carry millions of passengers. I sometimes wondered if my ship pined for those days, when her halls and atria, her vast concourses and plazas teemed with human life. Now all she ever had was me, and a handful of guests, if she was lucky. We rattled around like ghosts in an empty mansion. We reached the other whisking chamber. I tapped the go-board, knowing that in a few moments we would be on the bridge and that there would be no further reason to delay handing over the ship. I had been steeling myself for it ever since we had left Naume, to the point where I had begun to think I could sail through it without an emotional hiccup. But now that the time was almost upon me, I felt a tightening in my throat. This was not going to be as easy as I had thought. The room's walls flashed red. The whisk would be a short one this time. It would feel like an instantaneous translation between the two chambers. Something happened. I think I must have blacked out for a moment, because there was a stall in my thoughts that had nothing to do with the process of whisking. In that stall, I appeared to have been pushed violently out of the region of influence of the field, so violently that I had hit the floor, and was now lying in a shocked heap, not so much in pain, as waiting for the pain to arrive, which I knew with certainty it was about to do. I coughed for breath and groaned. I still had no idea what had happened, but as my blurred eyes resumed some focus, I made out a golden form looming over me, a form that was unmistakably Hesperus, who was unmistakably alive. Cadence and Cascade had vanished.
"We must leave," Hesperus said, leaning down to pick me up off the floor. "We must leave, and leave quickly."
Bruised as I was, I did not have the impression that anything was actually broken. The pain was too diffuse for that.
"Hesperus,"
I said, relieved and bewildered in equal measure.
"What? There isn't time to discuss it here. I pushed you out of the transit field just as it reached operating strength. Cadence and Cascade went on as intended. They've arrived at the far end."
"The bridge," I said, my voice hoarse. I was standing, though not without Hesperus's assistance.
"Can we return to the cargo bay from this chamber?"
My eyes were still blurry, my thoughts still addled.
"No. Got to get to the other side. Over the bridge." "Very well. May I carry you? It will be faster."
I do not recall if he waited for my answer. His golden arms swept me up and held me securely. Hesperus started walking. Then the walk became a pounding, superhumanly fast run. We crossed the shaft where the anvil-shaped machines rose and fell according to their own unfathomable agendas. And then we were in the whisking chamber. Hesperus touched the go-board. The ship accepted the command, still recognizing him as a valid guest. We slammed to the other end of the ship, to the chamber at the entrance to the cargo bay. "What's happening?" I asked, as some of the fog began to lift. "I tricked Cadence and Cascade," Hesperus said as we entered the cargo bay. "They were lying about their intentions. They wanted my ship. I was about to give her to them. What's to lie about?" "I don't know yet. All I know is that they've no intention of returning me to the Monoceros ring. When they interfaced with me just now, they were doing their best to kill me." Hesperus had loosened somehow. His voice was the same, but the speech had become more colloquial, less rigid and precise than before. "Why would they want to kill you?" "When they interfaced with me aboard your ship, their intention was to suck information out of me and leave me dead. Then they would lie and say I had died from my earlier injuries. They failed, then. I was stronger than they expected, and they couldn't be too obvious about what they were doing. Unfortunately, they left me too weakened to communicate my fears to you. Later, they were overjoyed that you wanted to convey me to the spirit of the air."
"Because they thought you'd die there instead."
"Which I didn't. When I returned from the spirit, there was still a spark of life in me. As we lifted from Naomi, they tried once more to kill me. They were doing their best to track down that spark of life and extinguish it. It took all of my resources and cunning to fend them off, without looking as if I was fending them off. I succeeded, obviously, or I would never have surprised them the way I did."
My golden conveyor paused.
"Are you having problems with your eyes, Perslane?"
"Everything's a bit foggy."
"I had to shove you very hard. It's likely that you burst some capillaries in your eyes. You may even have suffered a detached retina. I'm sorry I couldn't warn you, or prepare you for the shock. Speed was, unfortunately, of the essence."
"I still don't understand. Why are they lying?"
"When they interfaced with me, I saw a little way into their minds as well. They were glad that you complied with their request, Perslane. But if you had obstructed them, or given them cause for delay, I do not think they would have hesitated to kill you. Your only consolation is that it would have been spectacularly, mercifully fast."
I had too many questions to know where to begin, but all I could do was ask them one at a time. "What's happened to them now?"
"I intervened before you had assigned control to them. Unless I'm mistaken, they are currently marooned at the other end of the whisking tube in the bridge."
"You're right. They won't be able to whisk. Not without my say-so."
"Will the ship assign authority to them without your permission, even if it's only to use the whisks or open sealed doors?"
"No, we should be all right. They're effectively prisoners in the bridge. If they start to damage it, to try and force their way out, she should detect what they're doing and treat them as harmful elements."
"She'll eject them?"
"Not unless I tell her to. But she'll definitely lock them down with restraining fields."
"That may not hold them for very long. They are a lot stronger, a lot more resourceful than you probably realize."
Hesperus's voice took on a graver tone. "You must ask Silver Wings to eject them now, Perslane. If she can't eject them, she must destroy them."
"It isn't that easy."
"You can issue the command from here, can't you?"
"That's not the point. I can't just kill the robots or throw them into space. That's not how it works."
"They are not what they claim to be."
"But I only have your word for that."
I groaned, as much in frustration as discomfort.
"I don't mean it like that, but a couple of minutes ago you were dead. How do I know you aren't suffering the after-effects of whatever happened to you on Naomi? Those robots are guests of the line. How do you think it'll look if I go back down to Naomi and say I tossed them into space?"
"I wouldn't lie," he said.
"Hesperus, see it from my side. You're asking me to take a vast amount on faith.
You trusted me before."
"It's not that I don't trust you now, just that I need a little time to think things over. You're different. You even sound different. More like a human. How do I know something else hasn't changed?"
More has changed than you can possibly imagine. I am still Hesperus, but I am also much more than he ever was, and I am telling you that you must act against Cadence and Cascade. They can't do anything from the bridge. I can consult with the line, see what action needs to be taken. There isn't time. Those robots didn't need you to assign them control of this ship. It was just a step that saved them a certain amount of difficulty. It has been several minutes since they arrived. Centuries, in machine terms. By now, they are likely to be well advanced in their efforts to achieve direct control. They have probably already explored and discarded thousands of stratagems for gaining command. They will have thousands more to try. Sooner or later, one of them will succeed. There is always a back door. They won't get control of her. They will, given time. Time that may now be measured in minutes or even seconds. She is big, she is old, but they are clever and resourceful. If I was there, I could do it as well, and there are two of them. If you're wrong, and I'm shown to have acted against machine people, the blame will be all mine, and I can be very, very persuasive. Do it, Perslane. Time is not on your side. I am. Put me down, I said. I can't do this while you're carrying me around. Hesperus slowed and placed me on the deck. The unlit ships and obscure machines of the cargo bay loomed around us, heavy with the past. Silver, I said, can you hear me? The voice in my head answered, I can hear you, Perslane. Cadence and Cascade, the two guests I introduced to you before.
Yes, Perslane.
Are they on the bridge now?
Yes, Perslane.
Show them to me. A picture appeared before me, hanging in the darkness. The robots were on the bridge. They were standing quite still, side by side, with their hands at their sides. They don't look as if they're doing anything, I said.
They wouldn't, said Hesperus.
The words came to me with difficulty. Silver, I want you to immobilize them.
Do they pose a threat, Perslane?
Yes, Hesperus said.
Just immobilize them for now. Use impassors to hold them where they are.
It is done, Perslane.
The robots looked just the same. Nothing about them gave the slightest clue that they were now pinned in place, bracketed by a sheath of constraining forces.
They can't do anything now, I said to Hesperus. They can do everything they could do before. They are reaching out with their minds, trying to find a crack in your ship's defenses. She won't even know they're doing it. They're that clever.
When they succeed, Perslane, their very first act will be to disarm those immobilizers. Nothing you can say or do will bring them back up again. Cadence and Cascade will have free run of your ship, or more precisely their ship, since they will own her, and there will be nothing you can do to stop them. Within seconds they will have entered the whisking system, and seconds after that they will be in this room. Hesperus turned his head towards the door, through which we had entered. There is one of me and two of them. I will do what I can to protect you, but the odds are not in my favor, even now.
Even now? I asked, sensing an oddness in his tone.
Never mind. Please take me at my word, Perslane. We have been through a lot together. It would be a shame to end it all now, wouldn't it? Especially when we have so much to talk about.
I felt as if there was a boulder lodged in my throat. I should consult. I can be in touch with Campion or Bettany in a few seconds.
They will tell you to ignore me. From their perspective, it's a perfectly rational standpoint. But you do not have that luxury. You are in this situation, and I am telling you that those robots are seconds away from gaining control of your ship. They must be destroyed now, or ejected.
This is a hard one, Hesperus.
He was speaking faster now, as if he sensed that he had only moments to make his case. How did they come to Neume, Perslane? Did you ever investigate that?
Of course. Saint Foyn brought them. They were her guests.
Hesperus must have read that crack of doubt opening in my face.
Saint Foyn didn't bring them, he said. She may have thought she did, but that's not how it would have happened. They would have sought her out. They wanted to come here. I sensed that very clearly. They have business with Gentian line, but their arrival had to look serendipitous. She was their puppet, not the other way around.
She said she met them at a reunion of Dorcas line.
They would have been counting on a Gentian dropping by. If no one had, they would have found a more circuitous route to reach you, but their ultimate goal was to attend your reunion. What are they? Paslane, no more questions!
I nodded once. He had not persuaded me completely, far from it. But my natural inclination was to trust Hesperus, and he was right about Saint Foyne. There was something else as well, a kind of commanding gravitas about him that had not been there before, for all that his mannerisms of speech were less formal than before he had fallen ill. Silver, I said, my voice shaky, take the immobilized guests and eject them into space. Are you certain, Perslane? This is a very unusual order. By which the ship meant it was not something she ever recalled me asking of her, in all the circuits I had been master.
Yes, certain. Give them enough of a shove to keep them falling into the atmosphere for at least 100 orbits. They'll come to no immediate harm.
Executing the order, Perslane. I waited for Silver Wings to tell me that the robots had been ejected. And waited.
This is not a good sign, Hesperus said.
He picked me up again and started running. Beneath me his legs became a blur of pistoning gold. Silver, I said, raising my voice above the roar of the wind as Hesperus raced through the bay, confirm execution of last order. No answer came.
You've lost the ship, Hesperus said.
No, I said, refusing to accept it. All around, Silver Wings looked exactly the way she always had.
You mustn't blame yourself. You gave the order eventually. It's quite probable that the machines had already taken over your ship when you asked for them to be immobilized. They may just have been curious as to your intentions.
And now?
I think they will try to kill you and to destroy me. It is my hope that we can reach the shuttle first.
And then what?
Leave, and hope that we are not fired upon by Silver Wing's defenses before we have a chance to get away.
It was not far to the shuttle from that point, but it might as well have been kilometers as far as I was concerned. We passed many other ships that might have been equally useful had they been powered up and tested for flight. The temptation was to get inside one of them and bring it to life. Silver's jurisdiction reached into the cargo bay, but not into the ships inside it. With armor between us and the robots, we might last long enough to escape, but the shuttle was working, and I had left it idling, ready to be flown at a moment's notice. When we reached it, Hesperus lowered me to the decking, and I told the shuttle to open and admit us. As the hull sealed behind us, I allowed my anxiety to drop down a notch. Inside, despite my bruises and the fogginess that still afflicted my vision, I raced to the front and took the manual piloting position, thrusting out my hands like a knight waiting to be gauntleted. The shuttle formed its controls and pushed them obligingly into my hands. I disengaged the docking clamps and increased the drive from idle to taxiing power, sufficient to get us out of the cargo bay. I swung the shuttle's wedge-shaped nose around until we were facing the rectangular aperture of the open space door, visible in the gaps between a thicket of ships stretching nearly 7 kilometers into the distance. I had kept the door open after our arrival, knowing that I would soon be moving ships through the atmosphere curtain.
I think we can get out, I said, easing the shuttle forward.
If I had had a clear line to the door, I could have applied more power, but as it was I had to pick my way through the forest of ships and their docking cradles. Too fast, and I would risk colliding with something bigger and stronger than the shuttle, something fixed so firmly into place that it would be like ramming a cliff.
They know what we're trying to do, Hesperus said. How do you know?
The door is closing. I looked, but I could not be certain that the aperture was any narrower than when we had started. It was difficult to tell, with the angle changing all the time as I steered the shuttle around obstacle after obstacle.
Are you sure, Hesperus?
Absolutely. Would you like me to pilot?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
I will be faster. I am not disadvantaged by a peripheral nervous system. There is as much processing power in my thumb as in your entire skull.
Thanks.
It's a simple statement of fact. I can get us to the door sooner, provided you assign piloting authority to me.
Now it was clear even to me that the door was narrowing after all. The rectangle of space framed by the aperture was still 3 kilometers wide, but it looked much less than 2 kilometers in height, 1.5, maybe less. I snatched my hands from the instruments and said, "Assign temporary control authority to my passenger, to be rescinded at my command." Then I flounced back from the console and said, "There,
It's yours. Make this count because I was getting us there.
Hesperus stepped into place, his broad back between me and the console.
Thank you, Perslane. I shall do my utmost.
We got faster. We got much faster, swerving around obstacles, diving through the gaps between docking supports, skimming past obstructions with what looked like only millimeters of clearance. Hesperus was making such rapid course adjustments that the nullifiers were struggling to catch up. I felt the push and pull of inertia. Phantom fingers, eager to turn me into a pulp, if only they could get a good enough grip.
The door is closing more quickly,
Hesperus said, sounding outrageously calm even though his hands were a manic blur, like a conjurer speeded up. They must have sensed our escape intentions and activated some emergency override.
Can you go faster?
By accepting an element of risk, I don't think we have a lot of choice at this point, do we?
Do what you have to do. I'm just going to stand back here and close my eyes.
Next time, it might be a good idea to park closer to the door.
I was thinking of you. I thought it would be a good thing if Cadence and Cascade didn't have so far to carry you to the whisking point, in case you were still vulnerable to damage.
Then I bow to your thoughtfulness, and apologize for my uncalled-for criticism.
Hesperus cut a few more corners, literally and metaphorically. The shuttle bumped and jarred as it shaved past some of the obstacles, just clipping them. I do not know if that was accidental on his part, or a trade-off he had factored into his calculations. All I knew was that we were going faster, but that the door was closing even more determinedly, squeezing down until there was now only a dark slot of space through which we were hoping to pass. At last, Hesperus cleared the main forest of obstructions, leaving us with only a 2 kilometer sprint to the aperture. The door was still narrowing, but he could accelerate harder now. The walls of the cargo bay slid by on either side at a quickening rate, and I dared to hope that we were going to make it. I was wrong. All of a sudden, the shuttle bucked and swayed, as if it had run into a screen of invisible netting. The walls moved by less quickly. Hesperus applied more power, but the shuttle was getting slower, not faster. Scarlet warnings flashed across the console, and a chime began to sound with monotonous regularity.
"What's wrong?" I asked.
"Dry field intermesh," Hesperus said, rotating his head to look back over his shoulder. "It's what I feared the most. Silverwings of Morning must have engaged her parametric engine. The field effects are interfering with each other, and I'm afraid the shuttle is losing the battle."
"Can't you do anything?"
"You know better than that, Perslane. If I push the engine harder, it will either deactivate because of safety overrides or rip itself to pieces. I'm not sure I'd care to bet on which outcome would be the more likely."
Hesperus worked the controls again, more slowly this time. "I'm sorry, Perslane, but I think they have us."
"The door's nearly closed. Even if you got the engine working again, it wouldn't help us."
Silverwings must have been changing her course. As the door narrowed further, the dayside of Neume came into view. The planet was growing visibly smaller. 1 minute of acceleration at 1,000 G's was sufficient to put 18,000 kilometers between us and our point of departure. After the second minute, we would have travelled 72,000 kilometers, twice the circumference of Neume. Everyone I knew, everyone I cared for, everyone who cared for me, was on that dwindling planet. I had to resist the urge to reach out for it, to try to hold on as our acceleration ripped it away. The door closed. Hesperus dropped the engine to idle.
"We're in a lot of trouble, I'm afraid."
The air resistance of the pressurized chamber had brought us to a halt.
"We can't just float here," I said. "There's a vacant berth to our right. I'll risk a little power to bring us in."
The console flashed its warning and sounded the accompanying alarm, but Hesperus managed to guide us in, letting the shuttle thud into its restraints. The field clamp locked us home.
"We must be leaving the Neume system," he said. "This is one of the fastest ships in your line, isn't it?"
"Especially now that there are only 51 of us left. That's why Cadence and Cascade wanted her so badly."
"That's what I feared. It will be difficult for any of your fellow shatterlings to catch up with us, especially given the element of surprise."
"We can't just give up, go along for the ride. We don't even know where we're being taken."
"I doubt very much that the robots have any intention of taking us along for the ride. Once they have cleared the system and dealt with any would-be pursuers, I think it very likely that they will turn their minds to us."
"And?"
"They'll find a way to eliminate us.
I'll do my best to protect you, but there is only one of me.
What do they want?
To go somewhere.
They didn't have to come all the way to Neume just to find a ship. If what you're saying is right, then they'd been planning all this long before the ambush took place.
So it would appear.
He had turned from the console. His golden mask was as neutrally handsome as ever, his expression one of kindness, but beyond that there was nothing for me to read.
You know more than you're telling me, Hesperus. I got that impression from the moment you woke up. What happened back there on Neume?
We should review our situation, he said, ignoring my question. Does this shuttle have abeyance devices?
No, you'd never need them.
That's what I thought. It will serve for now, but we may be better off moving to a larger, more readily defended craft. If you have something with weapons and real thrust motors, we may be able to force our way out of the cargo bay. Is there such a ship?
Let me think. Those are pretty thick doors. It's going to take more than a laser or two to get through them.
See what you come up with.
All right, I said, flustered, my mind still having trouble catching up with recent events. I had been dreading the handing over of Silver Wings, but now I would have gone through with that gladly, rather than find myself a prisoner on my own ship.
This is all a bit sudden, Hesperus. You're going to have to make allowances. I have a peripheral nervous system, and it takes me a while to adjust to radical paradigm shifts.
I can forgive you anything, Purslane.
He turned to the console and made a few more adjustments.
I'll keep the drive on idle, just in case an opportunity presents itself. I don't think we should count on it, though.
I'm not. Do you think the others will have noticed our departure by now?
Almost certainly.
And?
They'll be struggling to make sense of it. It may cross their minds that you are the one stealing the ship, not the robots.
They wouldn't think that. But even as I said it, I knew he was right. I should have called down to Campion.
They'd have assumed you were fabricating details, making out that the robots were up to no good.
They were.
No one on Neume would have known that.
Except Campion. He'd have trusted me. He'd have believed me, no matter how outlandish it sounded.
Then I am sorry you were not able to contact Campion, but in the long run it would have made very little difference.
Hesperus put a golden hand on my shoulder, his fingers cold and hard, but also gentle.
It would probably have been futile. If the robots had already seized control of the ship before you attempted to eject them, as I am increasingly convinced they had, then they would have had no qualms about blocking your efforts to contact Neume.
I closed my blurred, tired eyes, wanting the whole universe to fold itself into a bundle and go and hide in the corner. But when I opened them again, Hesperus and the universe were still waiting to say something.
I'm scared, I said. There's never been a time when I wasn't in control. Even when we went to the spirit, that was our choice.
It happens to us all eventually.
He moved his hand from my shoulder and, as quick as lightning, touched his thumb and forefinger to my eyelids. I would have flinched had he been slower, but all I felt was a touch of metal, a spike of intense, cold, too brief to be called pain, and then his hand was lowering.
I have repaired your eyes. You had a partially detached retina in the right eye. There was capillary damage in both. I trust your vision will be clearer now.
Miraculously it was.
What did you just do?
He held up his left hand, letting me see the forefinger. Between the gold nail and the quick, a tiny harpoon-like structure emerged. It was a many-barbed thing of fractal complexity, its details vanishing down to a purple-gold haze, as if the thing was simultaneously shifting in and out of focus, or indeed reality.
I fixed you, Hesperus said simply. It wasn't difficult.
Could you always do that?
From the moment I met you.
But there's more, isn't there? You're different since you came back.
I can't do anything I couldn't do before, but I see things in a new light, and I know much, much more.
Because the spirit restored your memory.
That, too.
But not only that.
I learned a great many things, Purslane. I am still coming to terms with some of them.
But now isn't the time to talk about all that.
Not until you've decided whether we stay here or try to reach one of the other ships.
That has to be my decision, doesn't it?
I know many things, but only you know the contents of this bay. Think carefully, Purslane, because a lot may hinge on your decision.
So, I said, no pressure, then.
Part 6. Milady, Daubenton said, stooping as he entered my chamber, I bring you grave intelligence. It had been a fortnight since I had touched the blood-bound needle to my finger. I had expected Calidris to make his way to the Palace of Clouds within 2 or 3 days, 4 or 5 if one allowed for the difficulty of crossing open ground with Mordax's spies keeping watch. After a week, I had begun to have qualms. By the end of the second, I had begun to resign myself to the unpalatable possibility that Calidris was already dead. It had, after all, been a very long while since I had heard from him. But when he presented me with the blood-bound needle, he had told me that it would only work magically if he was still alive. I had felt no pain when the blood was drawn. I should have felt at least a prick if Calidris was no longer of this world.
Tell me this news, Daubenton. Calidris is dead. He was caught trying to return to the Palace of Clouds.
Calidris lives, if our agents are to be believed. Milady, we have committed a terrible error. I put down my mirror and brush. I had been attending to my hair, sitting by a window of coloured glass inlaid with pretty designs.
I do not understand.
It would appear that Calidris was already a prisoner of Mordax when you summoned him. He had been caught by one of the Count's raiding parties, one of a larger party of men. They were blacksmiths, artisans of some ability, so were not put straight to the sword. Mordax would rather enslave such men and have them equip his armies. Calidris had disguised himself well, and used blocking spells to mask his own magical talents, a difficult, dangerous venture, but it was working. Even Mordax's sorcerers were hoodwinked. He could not have kept the ruse up indefinitely. It was costing him an indescribable amount of effort, but it would have sufficed to protect him while he was under direct scrutiny. Later, when the men were put to work equipping Mordax's army, Calidris would have contrived his escape.
Pray tell me what else our spies have learned.
Calidris was seen by one of these men at the moment the needle went in. The man recognized the presence of magic. Blood had appeared on Calidris's finger without cause, and Calidris's pain was disproportionate to the injury. In the same instant, he lost his control of the blocking spells. They required a constant, taxing effort of the mind. The man became frightened. He summoned guards and told them what had happened. Calidris was separated from the common blacksmiths and brought to Count Mordax. By then, Mordax's own magicians had become alerted to the presence of a powerful new mind in the Black Castle. Calidris was unmasked. He was shackled and gagged before he could work magic against his captors. I looked at Daubenton with practiced skepticism.
Our spies told you this? If we have such men, why do we not already have the Black Castle?
We also have this, Daubenton said, sidestepping the question. He offered me a letter. I shuddered at the black-grilled seal. It was another communication from my stepbrother. I tore it open and read Mordax's gloating account of how he had captured Calidris.
You think I can't turn him, I read, but you're wrong. Anyone can be turned. Palatial turned me. I thought I was stronger than the game, that I could become Mordax without inheriting the mantle of his personality and his past. I was wrong about that, as you will be wrong about Calidris. I will tell him that you betrayed him for the return of your lady-in-waiting, that I asked you to give me proof of his identity. He will not believe me at first, but I have seen how men break. Time will erode his old loyalties and turn him to the will of the Black Castle, and then a magic beyond anything in your experience will be unleashed upon the kingdom. I looked at Daubenton with ice in my veins. We have failed. It's all over.
His eyes were heavy-lidded from too little sleep. Chamberlain Daubenton, Master-at-Arms Cyrillus, his soldiers and my highest ministers had thought of little but Calidris and the Black Castle these last days. Perhaps Calidris will have the strength of will not to turn against us.
No man has ever resisted. You saw what Count Mordax wrote in his letter, Daubenton. Do not pretend you did not open and reseal it before it reached my hands.
Palatial has changed him. I know what he was like before he went in.
Palatial, milady.
For an instant I had felt on the verge of some transforming knowledge, a secret that would put all our problems into a different, less harrowing perspective. It was as if I was a player on a stage, who had become so consumed by the role they were acting that they had forgotten that the whole enterprise was for show. Burdened with the weight of their character's problems, they had had a moment of epiphany, a realization that it was merely a performance, a disguise that they could step out of whenever they chose. I had been troubled by many such moments lately, a feeling that I was inside a theatre, that none of my actions would have wider consequence beyond its panelled green walls. Sometimes a word or phrase, palatial, ram's scoop, ship, lesser world, felt like an ominous key, one that was about to unlock great and troubling mysteries. Fortunately, for they could easily have become a distraction from the matter at hand, those moments always passed, leaving only a faint sense of mental disquiet. It is nothing, Daubenton. My point is simply that we cannot entrust the kingdom to the hope that Calidris will be stronger than any man who has ever lived. I hesitated, running my nails down the sharp edge of the letter. There has always been another we could turn to. When the possibility was first raised, I dismissed it, as I was right to do given the state of our affairs at the time. Now events have taken an even more ominous turn, and I must reconsider. If Calidris's magic is to be used against us, as I fear it will be, we must have an equivalent ally.
You are speaking of Relictus, the failed apprentice. Horror paled Daubenton's already sallow features. I did not agree with Cyrillus, milady. Relictus should stay where he is until he rots.
I was right about Calidris's magic, though it was months before we knew the truth of his defection. Realization came when the ghost soldiers began to attack our men. Count Mordax's one weakness had always been the size of his army, well-equipped, well-trained, ruthless in the execution of his orders, but stretched thin across too many campaigns, too many points of attack on the kingdom's borders. Our army was more numerous, but, it could not be denied, less effective, and it was only this uneasy balance that had kept Mordax at bay. Had he been overwhelmingly stronger, Mordax would not have had cause to take a hostage, nor would he have had a use for Calidris. Mordax was a man of the practical arts, schooled in the blood-stained science of war, and he had an instinctive distaste for magic. Nonetheless, I had never deceived myself that he would refrain from making full use of his new prize, if circumstances merited it. At first, all we knew of the ghost soldiers was reports from frightened, less than credible witnesses. A raiding party had burned one of the villages. The men wielding torches and pikes were the usual rabble dressed up to look like brigands. But riding with them, remaining outside the village while the burning took place, was an escort of armored men on waif-thin horses, lean and fast as greyhounds. Only one of the men rode a heavy charger, and he was the only one with his visor raised. The other riders wore elaborately jointed armor, every inch of their bodies protected by metal. The man with the raised visor wore leather with metal plate sewn all over it. He appeared to be leading the other soldiers, those with their visors down, but he never gave a spoken command. One of the villagers, driven beyond rage by the burning of his home, found the armored riders and shot at them with a stolen bow. He fired 6 arrows into the riders, but they either bounced off their armor or wedged into the joints between the sections, without obvious harm to the rider. As the brigands left the village, the armored men began to ride away to rejoin them. At that point, the villager fired a 7th arrow, and by lucky chance it found the flank of one of the horses, rather than the rider. The horse bucked and threw the armored man. He crashed to the ground, making no sound except that of crashing metal. Of the other riders, only the man on the heavy horse looked back. Then he swung his arm and the others galloped after him, oblivious to their fallen comrade. The villager left his place of cover to examine the tumbled rider. What he found distressed him greatly. The armor had broken, one arm coming away from the torso. Yet there was no sign of injured flesh, and when the villager examined the remains he found only empty metal, a suit of armor with no man inside it.
He understood then why the riders' horses had been so thin and fast. They had only needed to carry the weight of metal, not a man inside that armor. Thus it was that we first learned of the ghost soldiers. Within weeks, reports of them were arriving from all over the kingdom. They moved so quickly and with such agility that they could cross our borders where no force had ever done so before. They moved at night, as if it was day. Their horses smelled of death and corruption, as if they were the corpses of horses reanimated for this single purpose. They were never seen to graze or take water, and on the coldest eve no hint of breath escaped their lungs. And they came in such numbers. Whatever magic Calidris was using against us required only the production of suits of armor. Our blacksmiths could have worked as industriously, and it would have made no difference. We did not have enough able soldiers to fill that metal. Mordax could have as many as he needed. I knew then that we needed Relictus, that I could listen to my qualms no more. Chapter 25. I was stretching my legs on one of Ymir's bridges, transfixed by the snapping of the flags, their colors rippling against the sky, when Bettany found me.
"Campion," he said, lifting the black collar of his coat against the wind.
"Has Mazarian finished for the day?"
"This is about Perslane. We've just received some distressing news."
The wind had not troubled me until then, but it chose that moment to reach my bones. "What's happened?"
"All we know is that she went up to Silver Wings with the robots, all three of them. Now her ship's broken orbit, suddenly, and without announcement. She's heading away from Neume, at what we believe to be the maximum safe acceleration for that ship."
I grabbed at the bridge's handrail to stop myself reeling. The news had hit me like vertigo. "How long ago?"
"Less than a quarter of an hour. I came as quickly as I could."
"I need to get up there."
"All shuttles have been tasked for immediate use. I'm taking mine in a few minutes. You're welcome to come with me. I can drop you aboard Dalliance before I rendezvous with Adonis Blue."
I was so numb that I did not even acknowledge his offer. "What about the other ships?"
"Three have already been dispatched, with no one aboard them. They've already broken orbit, so at least we have something in immediate pursuit of Silver Wings. They won't be able to catch up, but they'll be able to get within..."
"Weapons range," I said, finishing his sentence for him.
"Nothing's set in stone, but we need to consider every option. It's unclear what's happened up there, Campion, but we do know it wasn't part of the plan. I'm not saying we shoot her down on sight. That'll be the last thing we do. But if we can cripple Silver Wings, slow her down enough to draw alongside..."
"I know what you're thinking, but Perslane wouldn't have taken her own ship."
"She didn't like being told to give it to the robots."
"Would you have liked it, if it had been you, instead of her?" I shook my head angrily. "This isn't how Perslane does things. She was going to hand Silver Wings over to the robots, and then come back down with her head held high."
"So what's happened?"
"I never liked those robots."
"You think they stole the ship?"
Bettany stared at me exasperatedly.
"They were going to get it anyway, Campion. Why would they take it now, when all they had to do was wait until Perslane handed it over?"
"I don't know. I'm just saying, I didn't like them. And don't start accusing me of being machine-phobic. I didn't have a problem with Hesperus." Then a thought barged to the front of my mind. "Has anyone tried to talk to her?"
"First thing we did, as soon as she broke orbit, but Perslane hasn't replied."
"That just proves she isn't involved."
"It does."
"Perslane wouldn't have left without contacting us, Bettany. She'd have made damned sure we knew her feelings."
"Perhaps she'll talk when she feels safe."
"She isn't talking because she can't talk. Something's happened up there." Slowly, the possibility of Perslane having been killed was beginning to dominate my thoughts, forming like a single dark cloud in an otherwise clear sky. I pushed it away reflexively, but it kept coming back. If for some reason the robots had decided to take the ship rather than wait for it to be handed over, they would have killed Perslane as soon as blink. "I have to get up there," I said again.
"We're going."
Bettany reached out and took both my arms, holding me roughly above the elbows.
"Campion, listen to me very carefully. We've had our differences. I don't expect you to like me, or ever forgive me for what I did to Perslane.
But understand that I had my reasons. I was thinking of the line, of this incredibly fragile, incredibly rare thing that we hold between us. I had to show the importance of discipline, now more than ever. But it wasn't personal. It wasn't done out of vindictiveness. And you know what? I admit I made a mistake by letting Mazerian run the interrogations. You saw that long before I did. I'm not infallible. But I'm not a monster either. If you can forgive me for anything you think I did to you or to Perslane, I am willing to put your slights, your cavalier attitude towards the line, behind us. I am offering you the hand of friendship, the hand of forgiveness. If Perslane has done something wrong, she deserves a chance to redeem herself. If she hasn't, she deserves our help, absolutely and unconditionally. I will push my ship to the limit to catch up with her, and I know you will do the same. There are 48 other Chatterlings who feel the same way. I waited a while, then said, "Speech over?" "I've said what I wanted to say. If you're with me, my shuttle is ready to take us into orbit. If you can't stand the thought of sharing a ride with me, I think Aconite or Tansy will be lifting off shortly." I gave the matter a few seconds' thought, then said, "Let's go." Line policy dictated that all of our ships should be in a condition of immediate flight readiness, so that they would be able to break orbit and sprint for interstellar space the moment the patrols detected the approach of a hostile agency. The possibility of flight had been at the back of all our thoughts, in every waking instant, on Naomi. Between 1 hour and the next, we might leave that world and never see it again. But that did not mean that all the remaining ships would be joining the chase after Silver Wings of Morning. This was an unexpected development, but it was not a reason for an emergency evacuation. Gallingale was out on patrol that day with his ship Midnight Queen, and he had reported no troubling intruders. No hints of killer fleets breaking down from interstellar speed. The line would remain in session, albeit in depleted numbers. In any case, at least half of the 35 remaining ships were too slow ever to catch up with Perslane, and of the remainder, there were fewer than 10 that could even be considered to be in with a chance. 3 were already on the way, flying without their owners. Dalliance would have been one of the slow ones, had it not been for the upgrades she had received courtesy of Ateshka. Now she was a marginal case. To have a hope of catching Silver Wings, her engine would need to be pushed well into the red, and I had no idea what kind of design margin now applied. "We've kept signaling," Bettany said as he brought his shuttle into whisking range of Dalliance, "but there's still been no response. If the robots are in charge, they can't have any demands." "They don't need anything from us," I said. "Do we have a handle on the trajectory?" "Heading in the galactic anti-center, parallel to the plane. She may turn once she's reached interstellar space, but for now there's no reason to presume she isn't still headed for machine space."
"There's something wrong about this, Bettany."
"The whole thing's wrong."
"Whatever's happening here, it isn't Perslane's doing. Deep down, you know that."
"It would surprise me if it was, but I've been surprised before." I thanked him for the ride and whisked over to Dalliance. Sensing my arrival, the ship brought itself to immediate flight readiness. By the time I reached the bridge, the engine was chafing at the bit, ready for the chase. It had all happened so quickly that I felt a sense of dreamlike unreality about the whole experience. In less than 12 hours, Perslane's ship would be travelling so close to the speed of light that the fastest ship ever built would still need 100,000 years to catch up with her. By the time it did, they would both be on the other side of the galaxy. The only possibility of reaching her lay in chasing now, with all safeguards thrown to the wind. I assumed my command position, laid in a pursuit course and brought the engine to 1,000 G's. Naomi fell away like a stone dropped down a well. Like all worlds, it had felt as wide as the universe when I was standing on it, but now I saw it for the little silver pebble it really was, a small round rock floating in an infinitely larger void, barriered from vacuum by the thinnest gaps of an atmosphere. For a few minutes I was alone, nothing within my immediate sensor reach. But then the other ships began to lock into formation around me, matching my acceleration for the time being. The 3 craft that lay ahead of us belonged to Charlock, Orash, and Agrimony. 5 ships followed. Mine was one of them, Bettany's another. The other 3 belonged to Sorrel, Tansy, and Henbane,
with Charlock, Orash, and Agrimony riding as passengers. Soon we would be accompanied by a sixth, for Gallengale had broken off from his patrol duties to join the chase. He was pushing at 1,200 G's, coaxing Midnight Queen to give up her last newton of pseudo-thrust. Of all the ships that would eventually make up the pursuit squadron, his had the best chance of closing the distance on Silver Wings of Morning, even though he would not be able to match Perslane's crew's ceiling. Within an hour we had put more than 3 light minutes of space between us and Niumi. It was now just a bright star astern, almost washed out by the light of its sun. With our engines stable, pushed to the currently agreed limit of 1,000 G's, we gathered our ships close enough for real-time conversation. A circular table formed in my bridge, duplicating the one that would appear on the other craft. Imagos of my fellow shatterlings popped into existence around it. Except for Gallengale, all of them were rendered solid. Gallengale's smokiness was to remind us that he was still more than a minute downrange, and could not be expected to respond immediately to any point of debate. At noon, none of us expected to be in our ships before sundown, racing away from Niumi, Bettany said. But say what you like about us. We've always been quick and adaptable when the moment forces it upon us. Charlock, Orash, and Agrimony, thank you for dispatching your ships ahead of you. Rest assured that the line won't forget your magnanimity. Whiskin's too dangerous, but if we can push to 1,100 G's, even 12, we can creep within shuttle range of our ships, Orash said, her hands resting on the table before her. She had long, sharp fingernails, painted midnight black for Seifel's funeral. I know I'd rather be aboard mine than sitting back here watching her from a distance. The 3 ships are already too far downstream for effective real-time control, and mine carries no protocols for this situation. Keeping her voice level, she added, I mean battle protocols, if it wasn't obvious. We'll deal with protocols in a moment, Bettany said. First, I'd like Campion to speak. He knows Perslane better than any of us, and for once I don't intend that as a criticism. We're beyond that now. If he has insights, anything that might bear on this crisis, we should hear them. I have no insights, I said, except for what I've already told you, which is that this definitely isn't Perslane's doing. She's either dead, murdered by the robots, or she's their prisoner. Why would the robots do this? Charlock asked. They've nothing to gain by taking her prisoner or even killing her. The ship was already theirs. If Perslane chose to go against the line, Tansy began. She didn't, I snapped back. I was with her just before she went up. She wasn't thrilled about losing Silver Wings, but she was resigned to it. She also wanted the robots to help Hesperus as best they could. If that meant donating her ship, she was happy to oblige. Could she have been bluffing? Asked Sorrel, scratching at the fine grey fleck down of his beard. I'm sorry, but someone has to ask. If Perslane had this planned out in advance, she wouldn't have wanted you to know about it. She wasn't bluffing. You can't know that for sure. None of us are mind readers. If she was sufficiently determined... I stared Sorrel down. We had never crossed swords before, but neither had I ever counted him as a close friend. Trust me, Perslane had no intention of taking her own ship. We'll assume Campion's right for now, Bettany said. Our primary objective is stopping that ship. Once we've done that, once we've recovered her, we can work out what happened. How do you propose to stop Silverwings, short of destroying her? Tansy inquired. Sorry, they probably could have put that better, but you can't just throw a rope around her and hope she slows down. We'll aim to cripple her without hurting anyone on board, said Bettany. That's the best we can hope for now. Has anyone tried signalling, Perslane? Asked Charlock. Bettany nodded. We've been trying from the moment she broke orbit, but there's been no response. Which proves nothing, I said. If the robots have taken control, they're not going to have any interest in talking to us. Do you think Perslane's still alive? Tansy asked me. I hope so. That's a non-answer. It's the best I've got. Please don't press the point. To my relief, she chose not to. There's something we do need to consider before engaging Silverwings, Orash said, tapping the tips of her nails against the ghost surface of the table. If the robots have taken control,
We can assume that they're acting as agents of the machine people. Firing on Perslane's ship, even with the intention of slowing her down, could be construed as a hostile act. Viewed from certain quarters, it could be interpreted as a declaration of war against the machine people.
No one would be that stupid, Agrimony said. This is an isolated incident, a ship taken without due explanation. We have every right to reclaim line property.
Orash's expression was steely, brooking no dissent. I said from certain quarters. At the very least, we might be banished from the commonality. And he'd hardly tell you how catastrophic that would be for Gentian line, especially in this time of maximum need. At worst, we might provoke the robots into retaliatory action.
We'll justify our actions, Bettany said.
Then you'd better hope someone's ready to listen. In between those outcomes is a spread of possibilities, almost all of them bad. Another line might decide to attack us, just to show the robots where they stand. If a sufficient number of turnover civilizations decided to combine their forces against us, we might face difficulties.
We'll crush them if they have the temerity, Bettany told her.
If the machine people turn on us, we'll crush them as well. They're fast and strong, but we've been around a lot longer than they have.
I raised what I hoped was the voice of reason. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. There's a lot we don't know about those robots, a lot we don't know about the machine people, for that matter.
What are you driving at? Charlock asked.
Just that we ought to keep open minds. We already have grounds to assume that it was my visit to the Vigilance that somehow caused the ambush in the first place. Dr. Menninx had his reasons for visiting the Vigilance. So did Hesperus. The same might also have applied to Cadence and Cascade.
They came to us, not the Vigilance, Sorrel said.
My point still stands. The Vigilance was suddenly the focus of lots of attention, and because of my strand we got entangled in the same affair. The machines may have decided it was in their interests to visit us instead.
Sorrel looked unconvinced.
I don't see why that would be the case. If the Vigilance is the thing everyone's interested in, why not go there directly?
The Vigilance won't deal with robots, only organic intelligences.
Ask them why.
Hesperus was planning to disguise himself as a human, but that would have involved considerable sacrifices for him, paring down his abilities until he could only just get by. He may never have succeeded.
Cadence and Cascade may not have been prepared to go that far, or had already judged that there was too much risk of detection. Can you imagine how bad it would have looked if the machine people were found to be infiltrating human civilizations? That would probably have been enough to trigger a galaxy-wide diplomatic crisis, irrespective of anything we do. So they came to us instead, knowing that we'd obtained data from the Vigilance that was in some way sensitive. They were hoping to access the information through us, bypassing the Vigilance completely.
Suttle asked, "You think they were paying us that much attention?"
"Someone was," I said with a weary shrug.
"You think there's a connection between the robots and the House of Suns?" Bettany asked.
"Everything's connected," I answered. "That doesn't mean everyone's working towards the same goal."
"I was prepared to believe that we might have incurred the wrath of another line," Bettany said. "That the ambush might have been our payment for something we did a dozen circuits ago, some careless act we barely gave a second thought to at the time."
"But you don't feel that way now," I said.
"Not if the machines are involved. And let's face it, they appear to be, don't they?"
Bettany glanced around at all of us.
"No disrespect to Saint Foyne."
"But it looks as if they used her to get to us," I said. "In which case, whatever we're involved in is of direct interest to the machine people. They sent Hesperus. I think they also sent Cadence and Cascade. The only question is, did they all have the same objectives?"
"If they all originated with the machine people, can't we take that as read?" Sorrel asked.
"Not necessarily. The machine people may be just as fractious as any human civilization.
Just thinking through the permutations, trying to shuffle the evidence of recent events into some kind of rational structure, was making my head throb. I pressed my fingers against my brow. "All I'm saying is, Cadence and Cascade may have been following different orders from Hesperus, or been given more latitude to accomplish whatever it was they were sent to do."
From where I'm sitting, they didn't do very much at all, Tanzu said. Came to the reunion, survived the ambush, spent time on Naomi, and then agreed to return home with news of the attack. What am I missing?
Nothing, I said, apart from the fact that they had Hesperus with them when they left, which presumably wasn't a detail they'd planned for. Other than that, though, unless they were being sneakier than we realized, they didn't gain access to any of our secrets, or learn anything on Naomi that we didn't learn as well. I don't even remember them paying much attention to the interrogations. I got the impression they were never particularly interested.
Maybe they already knew everything Grilser and the others were likely to say, Charlock said.
So, if it wasn't our secrets, if it wasn't the information known by the prisoners, what were they after? Asked Sorrel.
Something else, obviously, I said. Something that's either staring us in the face, something so obvious that we can't see it, or something even we don't know about.
But which has something to do with us, Charlock said.
Gallingale's smoky image spoke for the first time. Excuse the interruption, but it seems to me that we're all agreed on one thing. This is not in character for Parsleen. I'm with Campion. She's been duped by the robots. Let's not forget that they were the ones who first dropped hints that they needed a fast ship. It was just Parsleen's bad luck that hers appeared to fit the bill, and that she needed her wrists slapped.
Bettany stiffened his jaw, but didn't interrupt.
She's a victim of circumstance here, nothing more. Luckily, this is Parsleen we're talking about. She's smart and adaptable, and it's her ship that they've tried to steal. I'd imagine the chances are excellent that she's still alive. At the same time, we can't disregard the possibility that the robots may have gained control of Silverwing's weapons. It may be something of a challenge to approach her.
There are safeguards to prevent one line ship firing on another, Sorrel said.
After a minute, Gallingale answered, none that can't be circumvented if those robots are sufficiently resourceful. I just don't think we should be blind to the risks. But we have armor, impassers, weapons of our own, and a clear numerical advantage. I propose that we disable acceleration safeguards on the three lead ships, and let them get as close to Parsleen as they can.
Orash was indignant. I'm still planning on being aboard my ship.
Me too, said Charlock.
Ships can be replaced, Gallingale responded. The least of us is worth more than any ship.
And if this fails, Bettany asked, if we lose three ships, where does that leave us?
My ship has the best chance of closing the gap, Gallingale said. I also have armor and weapons the equal of anything else in the pursuit squadron. I'll be the next to go if it comes to that. He smiled tightly. You can be sure that I'm making this suggestion with a full appreciation of the consequences.
If you go in, we all go in, I said.
That's very noble of you, Campion, but we have to think of the line. Too much selfless bravery, too many heroic gestures, and there won't be a line. To survive, we have to indulge in a little tactical cowardice.
Gallingale smiled again. It was the smile of a man who did not place a high premium on his chances of seeing out another circuit. I'm not the bravest of men. None of us are natural cowards, of course, but we all have a healthy sense of self-preservation. Nonetheless, I have the fastest ship, so I am obliged to use it in the way that best benefits the line.
You do nothing until we've closed the distance with the first three ships, Bettany said. Even then, no action is to be taken unilaterally.
So it's decided, then? Orash asked.
Our ships become expendable.
Better them than you, Bettany said, his tone of voice letting us all know that he considered the matter closed. We've held at 1,000 G since leaving Naomi. Is there anyone who isn't prepared to increase to 1,200 as an emergency measure?
None of us answered immediately. We all knew that we would be pushing our ships harder than we ever had before. Even if the engines held, we would be at the mercy of inertia nullifiers, operating well outside their normal regime. There was a slow exchange of glances, a shared sense that we were in this together, prepared to shoulder a collective risk.
I'll do it, I said.
We'll all do it, Charlock said. All or nothing. The Gentian way.